This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
How did Rage Against the Machine become the machine? How do companies like Target, Bud Light, or all of our comedians who have lost their way find their way back? A conversation with comedian John Crist. It's the Will Cain Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? And welcome to Wednesday. Welcome to the week after the holiday, after Memorial Day. As always, I hope you will download, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your audio entertainment. I've been out, and I've missed you, for the better part of a week. Last week before Memorial Day, my family and I took a little family vacation. We went to Spain. We've done this, I don't know if we've done it every year, but I would say at least every 18 months. A trip, just the four of us. My wife, my two boys, and we go exploring. We've done Puerto Rico, spent some time in old San Juan. We've gone to Italy, toured through Rome, and then hit the countryside, small towns on the Adriatic Sea. Our favorite trip, I think would be voted unanimously, was a road trip across America, where we spent almost a month in a car going national park to national park. Zion, Grand Canyon, Yellowstone. We went to Mount Rushmore, up to Montana. It was an awesome trip together across America. But last week we decided, hey, let's go to Spain. And there was a lot of different inspirations for our trip to Spain. We wanted to see if we could catch a top-notch soccer game before the season was over somewhere. Serie A in Italy, Bundesliga in Germany, La Liga in Spain, or Premier League in England. We wanted to see Barcelona. I had a layover there one time and absolutely loved the food. So we wanted to see, hey, where somewhere we could get away for about 4 days. We're pretty economical travelers. We don't go five star. We use hotel points as many different places as we can go. And most of our vacations are kind of, like I said, exploration and physical. We hike, we walk, and learn to us new history. And Spain was awesome. When we got to Spain on a red eye, we immediately rented a car and drove 2 hours north of Barcelona to an area of Spain called Costa Brava. It is the stretch essentially on the Mediterranean Sea between Barcelona and France. They suggest it's like the California of Spain. In terms of geography, it's these beautiful, impossible cliffs dropping off down into the water with towns, little villages built into, almost embedded into the cliffs. And then what that creates is these little coves up and down these cliffs where you have beaches. They're protected beaches without much ocean chop coming in, but they're pretty and they're not big. Some of them are like backyard-sized beaches, and they are backyards for some of these homes that just almost drip down the cliff. You come out and you're in like a, you know, 25-yard stretch of beach with a cove to match, a little tiny mouth spilling out into yet another cove. The area that we ended up was this town called Begur, and it's a town of only 5,000 people that I think gets more hip and happening, more alive during the summer. It was pretty much, since we had beat the season, a ghost town. But it's got all these little satellite fishing villages up along the coast, like Agua Blava or Fornells. And we stayed in one called Fornells. And I'm telling you, you like walk these beach paths, stairs and steps, not a flat piece of ground anywhere to be found. And you're going through and around people's homes. You feel like this has got to be a private walkway, but it's not. It's just this stretch. It actually goes for miles and miles and miles up and down the coast, just up and down and around, along the water, up around the mountain, and will spill you out onto some beach. I saw this Twitter thread recently about the concept of vernacular architecture. It's the kind of architecture you can really only find in old towns, in old places, within history, not, honestly, in America. By the time we got to the civilizational stage in America, we were gritting out modular towns, which is great and fine for commuting. It's more efficient. It's better for sanitation, laying essential needs like electricity or plumbing, but it doesn't have the character. It doesn't have that sense of mystery, of exploration that you have when you're walking around, you know, half a millennia or millennia old villages in Europe where you're like, why is this human-sized alley here? You walk up and down. Oh, look, here's a little sign. Oh, with a little tavern. It's awesome because you're constantly discovering. This town was certainly whatever is vernacular architecture, because I don't know how you'd master plan a little village like Fornells. You can look it up on Google. You can see some of these pictures. It's the kind of thing where your balcony is level with someone else's roof and then them to the next, where the street is always below you, even though you're not really on the second floor. It's amazing, and it's full of wonder. The best day, I think all four of us would probably rank this as our best day. We took this path over to this beach called Agua Blava. There was a restaurant on the sand, and we sat there and ordered paella. Now, one thing I really appreciate about all the other three members of my family is not all of them does food exploration come naturally, but they were willing every step of the way to say, yeah, I'll try that. And no matter where we sat down to eat, I'm like, well, we're not ordering something that we could get in America. I'm always forcing somebody outside of their comfort zone. That's the way I am in conversation and in life. So we order paella, and it's coming out. I mean, the prawns and shrimp aren't moving, but they're not helped out in any way for you. They're full, you know, heads, tails, feet. You need to go ahead and work to get your meat out of that, or the clams. And it was really good. It was really good. It felt authentic. I ordered sardines. I ordered anchovies whenever we would go, because I had amazing sardines and anchovies in Italy. And I'm like, this is not what we think of when we think of anchovies in America. They weren't always a hit, but I was always pushing it. But after we had that amazing meal, we went and sat on the beach and, you know, we poked and prodded the boys to go approach strangers who were playing soccer on the beach. Now, listen, this is one of the things I love about the wonderful happenstance of my sons ended up playing soccer. It's the language of the world. It's the athletic language of the world. When I was in law school, I did a semester of schooling in London, and a buddy and I went to Greece for a while. We were on the beach in Greece, and we did take a football. We got a bunch of Brits to play football with, and it was fun. But they played soccer, and of course, we were there, and so we played soccer. So a couple years ago, when we went to Italy, my oldest son, who was old enough at that time, ended up on this beach playing foot volley with a bunch of Italian boys, a couple years older than him. They were 12 probably, and he was 9. Foot volley is volleyball, but no hands, no arms. So it's like juggling, chest, head, feet, all that. They couldn't speak a lick of English, and my boy couldn't speak a lick of Italian, but this was their language. I guess they spoke a lick of English, because I remember them saying, "Oh, good one, Charlie." And so we had this moment again where I pushed them here in Spain to go up to this guy. Now, this guy was in his 30s. He wasn't their age. Who had a soccer ball, and he was juggling it, and so ask him. I said, go say, what is it? Puedo, por favor, puedo usar su football. Please, can I use your soccer ball? And the guy said, yeah, and my boy started juggling. Before you know it, he joined him. And here he was, Diego from Chile, and my boy's juggling, you know, feet, chest, shoulders, head, trying to get their communal number up to like 30, I don't know. Each of them can juggle more individually. It's more fun and hard when you're kind of passing it around as you go, two or three at a time. And it was awesome. They sat there for an hour just on this magical beach in this magical cove on the Mediterranean in Spain, juggling this soccer ball after having an awesome meal of paella with some dude named Diego from Chile. And then we said our goodbyes, walked that ridiculous staircase back to our little hotel on the cliff. Just an absolutely amazing day. Then, after a couple days on the Costa Brava, we decided to go back into Barcelona and spend a couple of days in Barcelona. We've done the city tours. We loved Rome. You know, you walk, and oh my God, you walk. And we love walking. We are, as a family, somewhat averse to taking a cab. And in Barcelona, you see Las Ramblas, which is a pedestrian street with a lot of different, you know, food and tourist options. We went into the Barcelona team store. We had to go also into the Real Madrid team store. For some reason, my younger son has decided he's going to be Real Madrid over Barcelona. And we went to La Boqueria, which is an amazing market. I mean, goat heads and full fish, eyeballs, organs, which I want to, you know, I've been following the Carnivore MD on Instagram, and he's been really talking up how important and nutritious organs are, you know, liver, heart. They had brains in the case, so I was intrigued. They had full-on intestines. They had other body parts that I wasn't capable of identifying. They had hooves, and they sliced the hooves. You know, not like deli thin slice, but like, you know, like hockey puck slice of hoof. What do you do with a hockey puck chunk of hoof? I don't know. But then there's an assortment of chocolates to make your mind bend, and then gummies of every kind. You know, I'm talking about cherries and Cokes and everything, and you want to buy it all right here in this outdoor market. And of course, there's Gaudi. That's what Barcelona is. Architecture, it's Gaudi, it's Sagrada Familia, it's various houses and apartment complexes. We did that. We did Casa Batlló tour, and it's really cool. It's amazing architecture. I mean, from 1880s to 1920s was the time of Gaudi. And it's unique, and it's immersive, and it's amazing. But if it wasn't juggling a soccer ball in the cove of Agua Blava, I'd say the only other moment that had a rival for best moment for our trip was to go see a La Liga game and see Espanyol versus Atletico Madrid. Now, we couldn't go see Barcelona because Barcelona was out of town. But there's a second team in Barcelona. It's called Espanyol, who's in the Premier League of Spain, La Liga. Not for long, though. They're about to be relegated. But Espanyol, you know, if you could even see it on their emblem, they have a crown. Okay, so I find this is one of the things I've loved about learning soccer, is the deep history behind it as well. Whereas in the United States, you know, you basically have your allegiances because of your geography. Or if you're a bandwagon person or something like that, you follow your favorite player. Or your dad brainwashes you because he's from a certain geography. And they certainly care about geography, but oftentimes in one town, there's multiple teams, and those teams have meaning culturally and politically, more so in the past than in the present. But Espanyol, like Real Madrid, would have at one time been the team of the federal government, the Franco government. At that time, at one time, the fascist, authoritarian Franco government. Barcelona was the team of the Catalan independence. That region of Spain is called Catalonia, and there's an independence movement, the Catalan independence movement, to this day, voting to secede from Spain. And it is the team of separatism, of independence, of pride in Catalonia. That being said, I sat next to a guy, I said, nonsense, I like Espanyol, and I love my homeland as well. But there's history, even if it's, you know, in Rome, Lazio, I think, traditionally was the team of the fascist government back in the day. You know, I can't remember all of them. And in England, I don't think it had as neat and tidy historical or political divides. It may have, and I'm just ignorant of it. But that's one of the things I love about following, is learning all of this about various teams. So we went to the Espanyol Atletico Madrid game because Madrid was visiting Espanyol. Couple of observations. So Espanyol Stadium is about 20 minutes outside of Barcelona. It'd be like coming to Dallas and going to a Cowboy game and then finding out the stadium's actually, you know, out in Arlington. You're like, oh, Arlington. Okay, well, I guess I won't take the subway or walk. How do I get there? So we got a taxi. Immediately, I start thinking, well, these people haven't figured out the ownership of teams. In my one sample size estimation, how to monetize professional sports in the same way American owners have. I mean, you build a stadium here, and the owner buys up all the real estate around the stadium. Of course, he outsources the building of the stadium to the local taxpayers as well. But he buys the real estate around it, and he then leases it and develops it into restaurants and shopping. So when you go now, if I go to a Texas Rangers game out in Arlington, there's the Cowboy Stadium right there, but there's also Texas Live and shops and restaurants, so that I want to show up 3 hours early to spend more of my money around the stadium. And if I don't, and I happen to go into the stadium, the concessions and merchandising, it's ridiculous and over the top, and you can't make your way through a game in America without money falling out of your pocket. Now, not so in Spain, at least at Espanyol. And people had said to me, the cab driver said, oh, they have a very nice new stadium. New to them means 2009. It was built in 2009. But it's in the middle of, I mean, there's nothing around it. Like, no real development, no restaurants. And once you're in there, concessions, not easy to find. In my humble American capitalistic estimation, they're leaving money on the table. But there's also something pure about it, because once you get in there and sit down, people are taking sandwiches out of their backpack or whatever and just eating home foods. Another observation. Boy, the Spanish, they're night owls. That game started at 10 p.m. It wasn't over till 12:30. I think that's unique even in Europe. I don't know what the Italians do. The English, because I watch, and I do, if I do my math right, they're like Americans. They start a game at 7 or 8 p.m. 10 p.m. local time. I'm not talking about, you know, a West Coast game tipping off at 10 p.m. in the Eastern time zone. I'm talking about in the time zone you're in. The game starts at 10. These are party animals. How do kids go to school? How do people stay awake? The game was awesome. There was almost a fight that broke out. Espanyol's in rough times. They're about to be relegated. I mean, that means they're going to drop down to a second level. They're one of the bottom three teams in La Liga. They immediately fell down 3-0 to Atletico Madrid, who is one of the top three teams. They're right after. They're right there. Little notch below Barcelona and Real Madrid. And they have superstars like Antoine Griezmann. And they jumped out to a 3-0 lead. And there was a lot of tension in the crowd. Almost a fight. A couple Atletico Madrid fans in front of us. They made the mistake of celebrating the second goal. And some dude, two dudes, about, I'd say, 10 rows above us. We had nice seats, not that expensive. Really awesome to see professional soccer from that vantage point. Like, I could hear the players talking and yelling at each other. Really awesome. In soccer, the higher you get, you can see more tactical stuff. Like, you can see the guy, the whole field and the players move and see the aerial tactics of it. I don't think there's a bad seat in soccer. Down low, you can see the interpersonal physicality and communication of it. So, a guy 10 rows up from us who's like, there was that movie with Patton Oswalt where he's like this Giants or Jets super fan, obsessive. This guy looked like that. Like, he was taking this 3-0 defeat very, very seriously. And he wanted to yell at these Atletico Madrid fans, he and another guy, who they weren't together. We don't speak Spanish. I mean, I speak enough Spanish to get in trouble. But I could identify a few words. And my sons Google translated the one they heard the most. Okay, it translates into a lot of things, including, I believe, hooker. Starts with a P. And I don't even know if I can Spanish cuss on this podcast. I don't know. Would they beep out a Spanish cuss word? Don't know. But then the Espanyol fans around the Atletico fans took up for the Atletico fans, yelled back at the Espanyol, and who knows? I don't know what they were saying. It was all in Spanish, and it was very animated, very angry. I assume it was something like, you're giving us a bad name, calm down, you loser. I don't know. Cops came over, had to chill everybody out. And then something amazing happened. A total comeback. Espanyol, one goal. Two goals. They tied up three goals. I mean, the stadium's going bananas. And these people who've grown up with this team, right? And they live and die by Espanyol, including the crazy guy 10 rows behind me. These people, they had nothing. Nothing on my 12-year-old West. Within arrival and by the kickoff of the second half, there was no bigger Espanyol fan in the stadium. Couldn't have been. Sorry, couldn't have been. This is my same child who, watching March Madness with me, decided out of the blue, because they were on TV, I don't remember who it was. Oh, it was Creighton. that he was a gigantic Creighton fan. I said, where is Creighton? I don't know. What's their mascot? I don't know. But he cried when Creighton lost. Like, how could you feel so quickly that you know nothing? You've never... That's who he is. All the way in. God help him when he meets some girl. God help him. All the way in, immediately, right away, most passionate person you can find there. He's yelling for red cards, send them off. I mean, people are turning to him and to us now as a compatriot for their allegiance to Espanol. They're saying things to him in Spanish. Yeah, no, they're saying things, you know, bueno, you know, I don't even know. Okay, and he's, you know, he's nodding and he's with them. He's not with me now. He's with them. He's one of them. Send him off. And he knows every player, by the way, because he plays FIFA. He's insane about this right now. He plays FIFA and watches YouTube videos about FIFA. And he knows every player on every team. And he was telling me the best players on Espanol. But it was amazing. It ultimately ended up in a 3-3 tie. Then from the highlight was the low light. How do you get home from Arlington back to Dallas? How do I get home from this subway back to Barcelona? No cabs. No Uber. Two children. Middle of the night. I'm telling you, 12:30, 1 o'clock. Gigantic line for the train. I was like, babe, I don't even know which direction to take the train, and I can't read it. And by the way, one more thing. I speak a little bit of Spanish. I speak no Catalan. Every sign, the first is their local language, Catalan. Then Spanish. Maybe English down the road. I don't know which way to go. I said, we can follow the crowd. We could try doing that. I tried Ubers. I tried finding... We walked way away from the train station to find a taxi. Finally, we just submitted that we were going to be the people that held up the entire line, don't know how to buy a ticket. I'm going to just do this by Braille. I'm bumping into everything and I'm asking for help. And you know what? When you do that, it works out. The lady spoke English, helped us buy tickets. Another guy spoke English, said, take it to this station. Another guy said, this is the last train. You have to get on this train. There's no subway running this late at night. Okay, okay, thank you, thank you. We take the train back into Barcelona. It's now 1:30 in the morning. And we decide we can either walk back to the hotel. It's a 35-minute walk. Or we can try to hustle down a cab. And what do? Because it's what we do. We walked. We walked home for 35 minutes. Barcelona at night, not full of zombies like New York. I saw very few homeless, no crazy, insane people yelling at me on the street, no drug addicts that I could see, and I covered a lot of Barcelona in my walking. And we got back to the hotel at 2:30, whatever it may have been. Went to bed one of the longest days, the nights of our lives, but it was absolutely so much fun. And here's the long and short of it. I gave you that sort of travel log, and I really could have left you with just this. Man, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you're in Costa Brava, Barcelona, or Italy, or Yellowstone National Park in America. It doesn't matter. The most awesome thing about it was simply the cliched family time. I sat by the pool, and I had day drinks with my wife, and we talked. I had dinner with the four of them, and we talked. And it's different. It's different than sitting at your table on a weeknight after soccer practice, before homework, and having dinner together. That's important too. But this is different. Trying new foods, hanging out, getting to know each other in a different way. We've done this, like I said, half a dozen times, different places. And I hope that we can keep doing it as they get older. Because this is the time when I get to hang out with my kids where I'm not always dad. I'm not always on them. Do your homework. Have you, whatever, lifted, juggled, go to bed, take a shower, none of that. I don't care. Have a Coke for lunch. What would you like? I'm not going to say no. We're going to have fun. We're going to talk. Try something new. Order some food. You want to try that? Yes, you may have it. And I get to learn who they are as people, and I really like the people in my family. I would encourage you, however, wherever, find that. Family time. John Crist is a comedian. He has a new special out. It's entitled, John Crist Would Like to Make a Statement. Would Like to Release a Statement. He has released the statement. That special is out on YouTube. It's his comedy special. It was fun to hang out with John a little bit earlier this week. We talked about the state of comedy, how you form a joke, what happened. Is there an opening for someone that doesn't necessarily have to be conservative, but just reflect some values for comedians to once again be truth tellers. I think you will enjoy this conversation with John Crist.
We'll be right back with more of the Will Cain Podcast.
This is Jimmy Fallon, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a three-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
All right, let's John Crist, who would like to release
in the
a
studio,
statement.
Would like to release a statement's been released.
It has been released. The special has been released. Man, talk to me. So I'm fascinated by comedy as a process, but I'm more fascinated to begin this conversation with it as like a market. What I mean by that is everyone's talking about, oh, look at Bud Light. They clearly misjudged the market. Whatever there is happening to their company and their sales and their bottom line, it's big. Same thing with Target.
It's definitely real.
It's definitely real.
It's like, oh, it's like, no, it's really, it's definitely real.
And then there's you. And what I'm getting at some point, I'd say we're now a good 5 years into it maybe, everybody looked at the landscape of comedy entertainment and goes, it's just missing the mark. It's missing the market.
Yeah. It's, well, comedy was always supposed to be like counter-cultural, like kind of the guy, the big, the president, like the court jester. And the comic was always supposed to be kind of keeping everybody honest. And then you would think a comic would be anti-vax just by the nature of what we do. We're the guys that somebody on TV goes, hey, you need to.
No questions asked. You need to do this.
And every would go, wait, what? You would think. And that's what you say. Like everybody was like doubling down on it, on like getting like following the government and the mandates and whatever side you want to be on that. But like, how come there was very few voices in comedy, like over the pandemic, that were like, hey, I don't think so. Very few. I was one of them, but very few.
Let's rewind back to that time. So you're right. The idea of the comic, even going back, I love how you take it as far back as the court jester, is supposed to be. I don't know that we could say the comic was always the truth teller. The comic wasn't always right.
Not always right.
But one thing the comic did was go against the grain.
That's what you're saying.
Go against the consensus. Yeah. And then in that moment, in that time, you're right. Like there were so few comics who were willing to do that. And most comics actually became the enforcers of consensus.
Which was like, you would watch the late shows. Like during the Trump era, they would just crush him. I'm just looking at it objectively. They would just crush him. And they're still like, and whether what are you going to say, but like Seth Meyers and like all the are still going after Trump on there. There's no like, it doesn't go the other way.
Well, and I'm thinking about Colbert and his vaccine scene thing he would do.
And Kimmel and all, they were like coming very hard about like anyone who didn't get it was like, I thought we were this. And if you're going to go, I thought we were the anti, like the correspondence dinner, right? You always have the comic go in there and kind of.
Regardless of who the president is.
Regardless, and you kind of rib him a little bit. But now everybody goes, I'm not. It's too risky. For a lot of them, it's too risky.
Well, okay, then you're leading me to what I'm actually trying to get at here. What do you think was revealed about the psychology of so many of those people during that time? Like they were fake rebels all this time? Clearly, I think the comic, and I think it's bigger than comics. I think musicians. It's actors. They considered themselves countercultural, to your point.
And
rebels. And then all of a sudden, you're not a rebel. You're not just a sheep.
Yeah.
But you're the head sheep telling everybody else to get in line. Yeah.
The idea of Rage Against the Machine had a tour. And, I'm 39. So Rage Against the Machine, kind of when I was in high school, it was like this kind of like we're not listening to our parents type energy, and they were like mandatory vax at their show, dude. It's like
Against the Machine has become the machine.
Yes, was like you have to have a vax card to get into the Rage Against the Machine show. It's absurd, dude. Like, how will we not be like, what, guys? Or like, you should at least like on either side, like what you call in comedy is in essence like punching up, like. big corporations or the president or CEO of Apple, you can kind of make fun of, but like making fun of someone down, like someone that's, you know, less income or homeless, that's a little bit of, you always be punching up. And they're like, guys, why can't we, y'all, no one's going to say anything?
Because, so do you think they missed it, John? Like, this is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah,
were they
yeah.
always followers? Did they always want to fit in? Were they never rebels? Oh, were they only like, say, rewind even those people back to the middle school, you know, lunchroom table. Were they just looking for their crew to fit in, into? Yeah. Or did they not realize that the script had flipped? Did they not realize that, no, now you are the power. Now you have
the power. Yeah.
Right.
Well, everybody kind of goes, and Sarah Silverman, I think, said this in an interview, that you kind of go wherever the love is or the attention. Let's not even say love. Let's just say attention or likes. So you got people on the right and the left that you're like, how did they become this? They just kind of either tweeted or said some, and then everybody was like, yeah. And then they're like, I guess I'll just kind of go down this path. And then a lot of the algorithms on TikTok are, everybody's always talking about, you know, if you use this audio clip, it'll go viral. If you want to go viral, if you want to get the algorithm. Yeah, but to say what? Like, if you had all the eyes on you, you had all the algorithm, the juice, the heat, everyone who's looking at you, like, do you have anything to say? Do you have any substance? Do you have any point of view? Do you believe in anything? Or is it just kind of wherever the likes are or wherever the attention is? Yeah.
Well, that makes sense to me when it comes to actors mainly, because actors are, it's its own form of art. But it's not an art that requires, I hope this is not unfair. Deep intellect. It's a different skill of, you know, make believe and pretend.
You're trying to absolve yourself of intellect.
Actually,
disrespectful way, to take on someone else's.
Yeah.
System, yeah.
And you kind of you don't take on their, like, if I'm going to act as somebody, it's not my job so much to get inside their thought process, but in how they feel and who they are, their ethos. But comedians are supposed to sort of like look under the paper and look into the dark crevices and see things that we don't see.
Yeah.
I think musicians also are supposed to look beyond the obvious,
do a better job of it. Yeah, if you're making fun of something here, you have to be up here to kind of look down to observe it in a way that's funny. Like, if you're, easy example for everybody, it's like you watch a commercial with the side effects of the prescription are worse than the thing that it actually solves. You're like, if you have restless leg syndrome, this could cause nausea, stroke, death. You're like, goodness.
Hair,
like,
loss, impotency, but
you're
don't
like,
worry.
Dang, yeah, you're like, this seems like a lot. You have to observe that from a different level to make light of it. So you kind of have to see things. So I think comics are, a lot of artists are just going around ingesting everything from the world and trying to make art out of it. And sometimes it comes out, sometimes it doesn't. But yeah.
Yeah, I think what I was latching onto as well is when you say, you know, you've got the spotlight on you now. So what do you have to say? What we've learned, we should have known anyway, is fame is not correlated to insight. Just because you're famous doesn't mean you have something.
You think we should have learned that by now?
Yeah, I think so.
As it turns out, it should be like an equation up on the wall. Fame is not correlated.
Yeah.
Where somebody, you're like, wait, why are we listening to them about this again? Wait,
right.
What? Yeah. Fame is not correlated. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, you would think, you see kids right now, like I would think, let's say Taylor Swift or somebody that just, she liked when she was a kid. Take me for example. You like to do this thing. When I was with my cousins, I would like to make them laugh, right? You just like to make, and I would make these dumb videos on my YouTube growing up just because I like to do it. I thought it was fun to do. Taylor Swift just liked to play music, just liked to write music, just liked to write songs. All this fame, I don't know her personally, but is a byproduct, is an almost kind of a consequence of the art. And you see people now that just want to be fame. Like, that's not a destination.
Right.
That is that's not going to last for you. That's not going to take you anywhere. But if you do something and you love, if you're LeBron James, you love to play this game. Fame came with that. Your goal was never just fame. And that's what you see a lot today.
Let's talk about that process that can end up in fame. I'm always fascinated by everyone's process, writers, comics, whatever it may be. Because what the end result of the process is to the consumer is, oh, it's so easy and it's so natural. What I've learned and what we all should know is it's not. I mean, a book is a 12th draft of something through several editors.
That, probably. Yeah.
And a joke is the same way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. People say, I mean, you go to like open mic night on Monday night and you just got a kind of a pad and a piece of paper and you just kind of like if you're a band, you can practice it in the studio until it gets good and then take it out. A comic cannot. We just have to, well, here's this. And sometimes they like it, sometimes they don't. But that, if you're a true comic that you love the art, you enjoy that process. You're psyched to walk over to the comedy club and go, oh man, I got this. We'll see. Jerry Seinfeld, he's been on stage, obviously he'd been doing it for 30 years. The rush that when you got a brand new one and you're like, you would think you would know by 30 years in what's going to do good and what's not, and you still don't. You have to try it live in front of at least 30, 40 people to see if it has legs.
You know, I think the New York Times had an article, this was a while back, about a year in the life of a joke, and it was Seinfeld, I think.
Yeah, there you go.
And it was how the joke started on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And then, as you said, he tried it out in front of this audience, and then he changed this word, and moved then he changed the order of these two words just to see over a year's time the different impact it had on the audience until you get to the final result, the special, which you just did a special, and how many times that joke had evolved in that time.
And it looks like you're just like off the top of your head, or it looks like you're just, what else is going on? And you're like, that's not even close to how, if a great comic, when the final product is done, like John Mayer, makes it look easy, but he's been practicing that for.
By the time you get to the special, does it feel done? Or does it feel like, hell, I've got to do it now?
Some comics worry about kind of overcooking it. So you talk with your agent, a comedy special is about an hour. So you go, hey, how much? Where are you at material wise? Like, are you got 45 minutes from your old stuff to the new stuff? Do you have an hour? And then you tell a joke, and there's like kind of like a law of like diminishing returns. Let's say even something about like COVID, like that's gonna not be good. It's not good now, but like the more far you go from it, the less it's gonna work. So you go, I probably gotta get on this, post it now, or it gets like a kind of like a delayed. And you're like, man, you could hear the joke. If you do 5-6 shows in a weekend, it's starting to like a Bud Light joke. It was like killing. Now you just have to might move it to like a Target joke or something. But even those things that you couldn't put that on the special, because by the time a special comes out, that's going to be that's so like this week that it might. Yeah.
What do you have a rhythm? Like, I don't know. Again, I think this might have been Bill Burr I heard talking about this. Like, I don't know if you know
comedy, bro. Yeah, you know all the comics. Yeah.
Was it a 12-month cycle or 18-month cycle, he was saying, where, you know, basically leading up to the next special?
Yeah.
Right? Do you have a rhythm like that?
We probably do. So we shot one last June, just came out. So we'll probably shoot one in December. So like 18 months probably.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have one on the schedule, you're kind of just in this land of like, what are we doing? Like, if you don't have one set on the calendar, if I'm having one in December, I got, 7 months to see where I'm at, tighten things up. It's like training camp. If you don't know when the first game is, you're just out here.
And where does it start? On paper?
Running laps. Yeah. My buddy said to me yesterday, he goes, we live in the South. I live in Nashville. He lives in Nashville. His mom is like very, very Christian. We were on lunch yesterday, and he goes, my mom... So his mom like believes in like the rapture, like Jesus is going to come back and he said, my mom sent me an email the other day. It's like, hey, in case of the rapture, like here's my Facebook password, here's my credit cards. And he, at first he was like honored, cause he was like, she thinks I'm the responsible one. I'm the executor. And then he goes, wait, so you think
that I'll still be here after the rapture?
Hilarious. It's like, And he like called his, he called his like siblings. He's like, hey, did y'all get this email? They were like, no. Which is like, I go, my goodness, that's funny. I go, can I like, can I tell, like, can I, and I would, so that my buddy Nick told me that story. That's a real story. So I would.
He's not a comic.
No, he told me that at lunch yesterday.
So you get that for free.
I asked him, I go, can I use that? And then I go, I would, of course, make it me. So I go, my mom. And so every comic stories are like true, but they're not. They're kind of a collaboration of, and I would like probably add to it. I go, the only person that got the email was like me and my brother who voted Democrat, or like you would make,
yeah,
you would make it funny, and or that you would exaggerate, you would embellish that story, and you're like, man.
And then,
but if I like, I just in essence ran that by you, and you were like, that you just know that it has legs,
right?
You don't know quite what it's going to become or anything. But you're like,
there's something there.
But it took you a second to get it.
Yes.
So then I was like, all right, maybe I got to go back and. But maybe
I even think that look, if you let it sit.
Yeah, like, maybe just, let it sit. Yeah, because Jerry Seinfeld said a joke and a punchline is walking everybody up to a cliff, right? If the cliff is right here, you just step over it. It's like a knock-knock joke. There's no work. There's no reward. If the cliff is over here, everyone jumps and doesn't make it. So, and they're like, "What? Well, we didn't get that one." So, the setup and the punchline you want to work to get over there, and you want to also lose a couple people. And the ones that got over are like, "This is the best joke I've ever heard in my life."
That's a really good analogy. Yeah, because right. The little leap isn't fun enough.
It's not. It's like in the newspaper or something. It's like a joke. It's like da 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 da.
Right.
And then one that's like, I mean, I've scrolled past some on TikTok, and I'm a comedian. I go, like, did I miss, right? What is it? What's the joke? And then it has, like, you know, 150 million likes. And you're like, all right, somebody's getting it. I'm losing it. But then you watch it 2-3 times, and you go, oh, my God. Like, those are the best jokes.
Man, you've mentioned Jerry Seinfeld, so have I now. But you've mentioned him twice. So I guess I'm going to ask this question two different ways. Then first, like who do you study? Like if you've read books by people or even gone to their sets or whatever, however you study a comedian, yeah. Who is that?
Well, you would study Cat Williams is my favorite comedian. I grew up watching Brian Regan, and another comic named Tim Hawkins. But a lot of the guy, Bill Burr, is one of the guys doing it now that I think is, well, to be honest, he's very anti-countercultural. Mm-hmm. That you go, I can't believe he's saying this.
Right.
But it's like he had this joke about
never hit a woman.
Yeah.
I mean, say counterculture, yeah, like doing things you're not supposed to do.
But it's so funny. Yeah. He had a joke about it. He's like, is being a mom like really the hardest job?
Oh yeah.
And he's being facetious, but it's just so you're looking around like, gosh, like the joke about everybody's going back and forth on abortion. It's such a serious topic. And he goes, he goes with the thing about the cake.
Yes.
He goes, yeah, but if you put a cake, you mix everything in the cake and put it in the oven, you after 2 minutes you pulled it out of the oven and smashed it, you're like, it's not a cake. It's like, yeah, it was gonna be. And it's like, and you just put it. That's what a comic should be doing. That's what all the comics should be doing, looking at everything.
Yeah.
And I would even say looking at conservatives too.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely
looking at everybody and going, hey. And when there's such comics being like canceled for what they're saying is like, well, we kind of should be being that's yeah, you should be like kind of being kicked off places, or like that's kind of your, if you're like on the red carpet, like it's kind of like a little bit of a dangerous place to be.
Like, I mean, invited. Like,
yes,
yeah, yeah,
kind of now, but there's still like the award shows for like the best comic, but with the athletes and the musicians and the comics are celebrities now. Comics weren't usually celebrities, but now we are also have money and are on the red carpets and are have followings as big as and or bigger than other people. But it sacrifices every time you see, like, that's why comics, most all the comics just have podcasts, and a lot of them are huge, similar to this. It's just because you can kind of say whatever you want. But if a comic takes a Sprint ad and now he's got $2 million in his pocket from Sprint or T-Mobile or whoever, it just gets a little like diluted a little bit.
I'm
but that's
you.
Everybody. Everybody has to feed their family.
That's me too.
It's me too. I'm not here to be like, I'm the freedom of speech. Like, come on. That's everybody.
My goal is to be honest with my audience. In that respect, you would have to acknowledge, look, there's ads pay for the content unless the consumer pays for the content. Yeah. And the purest form of comedy, or perhaps what I do, would be subscription or purchase or a la carte.
But even then, if you're on some platform to get them there, either Patreon or YouTube, even the purest ones, they're like, all right, if we're going on the Daily Wire versus you're going on Netflix, you all right, who's paying for this? You kind of.
Right.
But everybody's diluted a little. But you can't be 100% the purest, because you still have to go to a comedy club and they still have to. You can't just go out on the street corner and say stuff. You can.
Hey, it's interesting you bring up podcasts. Every comedian has a podcast. The guy that made me think about this, and he's not a stand-up comic, is Will Ferrell. So Will Ferrell, you know, had a run there, and everybody has a run in any business, my business, sports, your
heck
business.
Of a run, heck of a run.
Yeah, it was an amazing run.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's over either, but there was a period, it may have been a decade, where it's just like everything he did was hilarious.
There was a Will Ferrell era.
Right.
Yeah.
But, John, I always felt, and this is subjective, but, okay, then he goes and he sits down with whoever, like Jimmy Kimmel or Letterman, whoever it may be, right? Yep. And I'm like, not as funny as the guy I see in the movies. And what it made me realize is not just the process we talked about earlier, but the skill set. It's like, it's okay. I think we sit and we think, you're comic. That means you're funny.
And you're funny
all the time in any medium. And that's not true. And it's like,
not even close.
I see these comics on podcasts and like, oh, that's not that funny. You know, like,
Not that funny.
It just, I don't know if there's an athlete's or sports analogy there, but the idea there's stand-up comedians, there's sketch comedians, and then there's
be an improv comic, so like a come up at like Second City, like a that type of thing, where somebody writes, if you're sitting down to write a script and you're in Hollywood, you're like Will Ferrell, you're writing it for Will Ferrell. I don't know what he's like in real life, because he's not a comic. He's not a stand-up,
right?
Vince Vaughn had a comedy,
absolutely.
Remember that the comic? What was it? Whatever it's called, the comedy something. And he brought out four comics. He could sell tickets. He just came out at the beginning and was like, "What's up? Good to see you. Tells a funny story. Now I have comics,
right?
Because he's not what's her name? Tina Fey. Not a stand up,
right?
Improv comic, a Saturday Night Live comic. Yeah. And sometimes you get under the hood a little bit, and you're like, oh, like maybe there were. Maybe it was best that they were just in the movies, because all the celebrities prior to like 2006, like who is Tom Cruise? Who is Tom Hanks? We don't know. Right. You know him from the roles. But now people, you know them because they're social media.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
What do you think right now is the height of a comic's achievement? Like, if you're working towards something, what are you working towards?
I mean, you would say, honestly, the biggest, I don't even know what this says about the industry or not, but the best thing you could do in all seriousness is be on Rogan.
His podcast?
Yeah. And that would be bigger than The Tonight Show. That'd be bigger than I mean, you want to have your art out there, so you have to have a medium to produce specials. But Rogan's even said he's going to put his next one on YouTube.
his next special. Mm-hmm.
So there's no, you go, if you get a special on Netflix and you don't connect with the algorithm, you're done. You got to go. If you're not on the top 10 and you want to watch my, I go, hey, dude, check out my special. You got to go into search, Jay.
Then you're done.
Oh, yeah. H. You're done.
Right.
If it's not, so you go, if it goes over there, great, but you could. I think you want to sell tickets.
So the
you want to sell live tickets.
The height is to make it to Rogan's podcast, because then whatever you do, it will sell tickets.
Yeah.
Here's why I asked you that question, though. So again, we've invoked him several times, but so I remember Seinfeld talking about this. If you were a stand-up comic in the 80s and 90s, yeah, the height of your achievement would be to get a network sitcom.
So,
this is back to what we were talking about a minute ago. So the height of your achievement, you're going to do stand-up, and you're going to become the best stand-up. And the height of your achievement means you're going to go do something else. Because a sitcom is something different. Back to these skill sets, it didn't make any sense.
A way different skill set, by the way.
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense that, okay, you've become the best at this. Yeah. That means you now have permission to do something completely different.
think about Jimmy Fallon. Or think about Stephen Colbert. Was it unbelievable, like Stephen Colbert, unbelievable social commentary. When he was on The Daily Show, there was nothing better. Him and Jon Stewart on and that was a great example of keeping everybody honest. The Daily Show back in the day was keeping everybody honest. And now you're like interviewing like Kim Kardashian about her like children's book. Right? You're like, this is what we're doing? So he does it. Or like Fallon. Yeah, a lot of like, that wouldn't be my goal.
To become a variety show host?
No.
Late show host? No,
that would not be my goal. Because you want to get the things that are in here and in here out effectively. But again, a sitcom, maybe what do you got to do to get to syndication? 3 seasons or something like that?
I don't know what it is anymore. Yeah,
because I don't know what it is. Yeah, who
that's
even
what
knows?
The cash was to go into syndication.
But going to, like when radio first came out, radio was out, but all the personalities are on radio. And now they're on television. It's like to go from internet popularity to television is like we have 7 million followers ourselves. So like to go to a streamer that has less followers than we do would be like, why would you go over there? You could do it yourself if you had the financing to produce it. Everybody just wants to own their own stuff and get to their people.
The Louis C.K. thing.
Yeah.
Just put it on your own website.
Why would you? Now, he had ads on TV.
Right.
But he's like, what? Well, why would I? That doesn't make sense. Why would I go over to Netflix unless they can get you to a larger audience than you already have? But he's the biggest. So.
It seems like comics are more like the height of your profession is more in line with the actual profession itself these days. Like the thing that you
would hope.
You hope to do is exactly what you're doing, just to the biggest possible audience and an audience that is actually, to your point, dedicated to you.
They find you. Yeah. So if you go, you just want to make the stuff that you have to get out. And if you can put in the easiest way to share anything is YouTube. So you go, hey, here's, if it's behind a paywall, there's less people are going to see it. But if you want to get the ideas out, if you do something of note, that is exceptional. Everyone in this country will see it tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You and me, everybody, the producer, if he makes something that is unbelievable, we will see it tomorrow.
You just need Rogan to tell everybody about it.
Yeah. You need Rogan to tell everybody. Well, it depends. Yeah. But again, what are you going on Rogan for? You're going to get him into your kind of sphere of influence, I guess. So if somebody watches.
Have you been on Rogan?
I have not. No.
Well, what's going on? Yeah. Neither have I.
Yeah.
How can we get this to happen?
Yeah. What do we do? Yeah. I don't think it's that simple. Yeah.
What about YouTube? Has YouTube ever told you? Has it ever, in any way, soft or hard, controlled the things that you say?
Again, nothing is 100% sincere, but it's less. So, but there's guys, the Nelk Boys, who have one of the biggest podcasts, this is back in 2021, had Trump on.
Is that Full Send?
Yeah. And then got him removed.
Yeah.
They go, this is hate speech or this is against our policies when it's gone. So, and then if they take away your platform, you're done. You're not done, but...
And then you self-censor. They don't have to exert hard influence on you.
Yeah.
You start looking at the things that get people deplatformed, and you start saying to yourself, let I'm not going to write that
joke. Bargain a little bit. Yeah, so if you... I remember going to... one of our last specials, I was like, well, where is this going? And who, I can't legally say who was doing it because we're still kind of going back and forth with them. But they go, you have to take this part out. And I go, really? Like, that's the joke that we can't say? It was just like, and then if you go,
can you tell me what the joke was?
Yeah, the joke was I go, you ever had someone ask you to pray for something so stupid? You just go, I ain't praying for that. And then it's like, it's a joke on our faith, the way we grew up. It's like one of my aunt's friends down in Florida goes, there's a hurricane coming towards the shore. It's like, our friends have a $7 million house on the beach and it's right in the, can you pray? And I go, what am I supposed to pray for? That's like with all the widows and orphans and missionaries all around the world, Jesus, be with all the orphans and widows and missionaries. Also, you know, the Goldsteins. And I just thought Goldstein, the same with the Jerry Seinfeld. I thought, what name would encompass like rich people? That's all I was thinking. I was like, you know, like Jesus, you know, the Jacksons, that doesn't, or you know, the Millers, that doesn't, it's like the
it's the name that got the
good, they, because it's anti-Semitic.
Really?
Because they say, you don't say Goldsteins.
But if you said Cain, it'd have been fine.
Oh, yeah. Or so we changed it to like Greenbergs or something but that's still, it's still Jewish.
And
but
I
go, they let that slide. But I had to go in and audio like this in a studio and redo the live audio.
Really?
Yeah. You can see it on the special.
But wait. So, okay. If you use a stereotype of a rich person, use a Jewish name, that's not a Jewish name.
Yeah.
Use Goldstein, that's anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. But you replace it with another Jewish name.
Yeah.
Greenberg, and it's not anti-Semitic?
Make it make sense. That's what everybody is saying. Because they go, make it like, unfortunately, what got Trump elected was trying to like, silence him, because like just put everything out there and let the best ideas, that's what any healthy society should be. But when you go yes, hey, don't full send, you can't let people hear this. You are not an informed, intelligent adult. We don't even trust this information with you.
Mm-hmm.
And you go, I'm going to go on Substack. I'm going to go find that because I want to know what they're saying. That's what everybody's saying about social media. Make it make sense.
John, I want to ask you about this. I'm fascinated by this. I remember talking to Jimmy Fallon about this. I was hanging out with a friend last night. We were talking about people in different industries. We were talking about tech, and he's like, yeah, he would make eye contact with you. You know, this guy, and he's giving me stereotypes of like, he's pretty big tech players. You know,
yeah, big ones.
And I was like, I was asking Jimmy this about comedians. What do you think it is, if you've been in comedy clubs, you've been in the green room behind the scenes, you've hung out with your friends with comics, what is it? There is something in you guys that innately wants to make people laugh, right?
Yeah.
What do you think, sort of psychoanalyzing yourself and all the people in your industry, what is that? Is it insecurity? Is it a need to fit in? Like, what is the personality characteristic that is consistent among comedians?
I think there was – so I remember growing up in church. My dad's a preacher. And I remember I was one of eight kids. And I just kind of didn't get a lot of attention at home. But I remember on Sunday mornings at our church, there was these girls that were like, you know, the pastor's daughter or the other or they were just there, and there was my buddy Robbie and Nathan, and I remember like them like loving me. They couldn't wait for me to get there, and because I was funny, and I mean that's as early as I can remember of being making them laugh and making like we like him. So, and I remember getting kind of you say insecure, maybe getting a hit of worth based on the laughter. And I'm doing it professionally now for the last 10, 12 years, but I've been doing that.
It's really interesting.
My whole life. And I would also, I would say that's the easiest, like if you meet me, you're on the street, we're in the subway, we're in the airport, that's going to be the first John that you're probably going to meet.
The one that wants to make you laugh.
Yeah, you're going to meet him first. Yeah, yeah. You're going to meet the insecure, not insecure, but we're on an airplane or you're going to meet him first. Yeah. And then Bo Burnham has a great bit as a comic. He says, we're striving to give to other people what we could never give ourselves.
What is that?
Happiness or joy or something like that. A lot of comics struggle with like depression and suicide, but I kind of reject that a little bit because a lot of everybody struggles with suicide, but we just know about it because comics are very forward facing with their jobs. Mm-hmm. A lot of dentists, a lot of cab drivers. I'm sure the suicide rate is probably similar. You just know about comics. Mm. That's the difference. So, but you know when people come into. I was at a comedy show a couple nights ago. And there was the comic was making a joke about a CPAP machine. He goes, isn't that really kills romance? And he goes, good night. And the people, and I saw this couple, the wife was just like ribbing her husband and just, they were dying. They were crying, laughing. And you know that has been a real issue in their house. That romance and their relationship has been affected. He has shame over it, right? She has – there's a lot of emotions around that scenario. And the comic presented it to you in a way that was so helpful and so therapeutic to you that you go, oh, gosh. Mm-hmm. And that – I know what that is. And I go out – people all the time are like, the show's sold out. Can we get tickets? I go – I'll find a way to put you on the list because I know what that does. If it's done well, sometimes it's not done well, but if it's done well, the comic, you go, gosh, dude, that is so helpful to me in some, whatever
it's
that
the
way
tea
is.
Kettle blowing off. It's like pent up inside.
Yeah. And it's everybody out. Comes home from yeah. work. And I saw a quote one time. It said it was about some school board, you know, getting rid of band or art class, or they go, just don't forget, every time you were in the lowest point in your life, you went to art. You went to a book, a music, a comedy, something you went, or even a sitcom or a movie. You went to, when I've been in my darkest days, I love watching Shawshank. You know that movie. We grew up in like that movie takes, like, whoever made that piece of art is just.
I really like that. Whenever you've been at your lowest moment, you've almost always gone to art.
Always. Yeah. You don't go to statistics. You don't go to reason. You go to this feeling, and usually brought on by art. Music, when you're depressed, you're like, yeah, yeah.
I love thinking about different personality traits that lead people to different walks of life. I did a series last summer with all these guys who are elite warriors, SEALs and Delta. And that's what I always want to know from all those guys. Like, what is it in you that you saw also is in everyone else who does what you do, you know? And I mean,
but you don't have it. So like what
and I don't have,
right? I don't have either, but I have, what is it? My girlfriend works in the news and she's like, you know, you go out to these crime scenes and you go, she's like, I know when something happens in your city, you turn on the news. And you know how important that job is to whoever's in charge of the trash on the island of Manhattan. Not the guy that gets it. The guy that makes it. He wakes up and thinks about that. How to do it best. And he's like, I bet, I don't know him, but he believes he put on this planet to solve that.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet he loves it.
It's funny you saying that, like your girlfriend's in news. I've asked that question of so many different people and I've never thought about it in what I do. Like, what is the commonality?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I never stepped back and said,
Or is it something in your childhood that you
yeah, I don't know.
Maybe no.
Yeah, I know yeah. I care a lot about the truth. Yeah. I get really upset when people lie to me.
There you go. Like, there you go.
But I'm also really curious. Like, I want to read and learn. Like, why is this?
Yeah.
And then also want to debate and win a little bit.
Yeah.
But I also think that a lot of people, but back to you where we started this conversation, we can end here as well. There's a lot of people that do what I do that not everybody, clearly. I have respect for a lot of people, but I see way too many people whose end goal in this seems to be the fame. Like, you did this
unfortunate.
Because you want to see yourself on TV. And that was what felt good to you.
Yeah.
And
that hit.
That hit.
That little, like, ego, a little bit of an ego bump. And I think everyone would be lying if they said that wasn't a part of it.
I'm sure, yeah.
And a comic the same. You're like, I just want to get these creative ideas out. You're like, yeah. But also,
right.
When like celebrities are like, we repost you or you get the check, you're like, oh, that feels good too. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, that sure, being on television is a part of it, but do you care about, that's not going to sustain you.
Right.
Do you care about, and even if you go, yeah, you're like, hey, like, let's say news channels or traditional news shut down. You'd be like, well, I need to. Would you still be wanting to, like, find out? And I bet you would.
I think I would.
If something happened, you got, I want to know in the purest form before technology even existed, if there was you live back in caveman times and there was a theft or a crime, you would be like, hey, wait. What?
Especially if they were pointing at the wrong guy.
Yeah.
And they were lying.
How come he didn't, and maybe other people would just go about their day, get on back to work and whatever. And you go, wait.
Right.
How come? And then you would, I would bet you would arm yourself with that truth. And then you go tell everybody.
Yeah.
You go, hey, he didn't, I found out that he was actually, even this is back in the caveman time.
Right.
That.
Yeah.
I have YouTube now or stand up now, but even if that was
you'd be the guy in the cave going, "Hold on, everybody. Yeah, yeah. Have you ever noticed
what's going on? What's the deal with hieroglyphics?" I don't know. Yeah, yeah. You were naturally
from the fire.
That's maybe from God or something. I don't know what I don't know what you'd say what that is.
This is where I wanted to go at the very end of our conversation. It's where we start. So I don't know how you describe yourself. Like, you definitely faith.
Yeah. Christian.
Conservative, I don't know. Yeah.
Is that the part we're going to clip?
Well, no, the reason I don't, like, if you don't want to be political, I don't want to push people into politics. I also don't think it is political to say, oh, I lean more conservative. Yeah. You know, it doesn't mean it's how you vote necessarily either.
Right.
But where I wanted to go with this is, so we talked about 5 years ago, the sort of way that this whole industry was lost and it created this market opening, right? Yep. And then you see guys like yourself, guys like, I think Burr did a lot of this. I think Chappelle did a lot of this. I think Bill Maher has done a lot of this, and he's a man of the left.
Yep.
But so do you think the market – do you think it's happened? Has it turned? Comedy, has it turned towards back to being what it's supposed to be?
Yes. Yeah. But it doesn't turn – it takes – we can't say whatever we want, right? We say things. If the audience, they're like, how does this comedian get to say whatever he wants? We don't. It's the opposite. If you say it and it doesn't connect, like if I was in like Jacksonville or something, I was like, I'm just making something up that wouldn't be true. What's up with all these Russian people here? They'll be like, what? It's not a real.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't go anywhere. You can say whatever you want, but everybody's gonna be like, "What?" It doesn't take. But you're like, "Hey, Jacksonville, like these streets are." It seems like up. And he's like, "We got to wrap this show up because I bet a bunch of y'all's cars are probably on cinder blocks in the parking lot." Everybody dies laughing.
Right.
You're like, "Okay, so that was a true thing that exists."
Right.
So comics, I think the tide is turning because people are starting to be like, "All right." And what happened during COVID was tremendous for comedy because everything was kind of upside down and you had people that were trying to go do their jobs and like work. And you go, we're at the airport and we got to stand 6 feet apart from each other, but we're about to get on this plane. Hmm. And they didn't know how to synthesize it into jokes, but they go, that's it. And that's all you need is the society or the people to be like, Mm-hmm. And they don't, they're not professionals, so they don't know how to, but they go, what?
Yeah.
Or that's all you need. And then a comic, if the comic is doing it right, he's voicing that. That's it.
I think comedy has started to, I don't know, not the industry as a whole, but, and you know, it's the leading indicator, and yeah. other forms of art have not yet followed. And I think that's where the next market opening is. Like, I think TV and movies and.
Oh, Hollywood is not.
Yeah.
But where it is happening is, but again, anything that Hollywood is putting out or syndicated, like television is nobody's watching it. Nobody's watching a sitcom. Everybody goes to work, okay? Everybody has 8 hours at work. They're getting off work. They're eating. And then they got like a window there, maybe an hour. And maybe you can do a little bit while you're at work and everybody's on their phone. So where are they ingesting it? And it's podcast. It's YouTube. I checked into the hotel last night and I never turned on the TV.
Yeah, I don't anymore either.
That's crazy, dude. Yeah. But people that like you, they were like, oh, I got to catch up on Will's pod, or I got to.
That's why this is on YouTube. Everything's on, you know, we're everywhere.
And that's why that's where you can go if you feel about, you can find a comic that shares that message with you.
Also on YouTube, John Chris.
Also on YouTube, baby. Let's go.
You would like to release a statement. And he has.
Statement has been out.
Go check it out.
Let's go.
All right. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Will. I appreciate it.
There you go. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with John Crist. Again, the special is on YouTube. It's entitled, John Crist Would Like to Release a Statement. Check it out. Follow him on any of your social media platforms, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. And if you think it's so deserved, leave a comment or a 5-star review for this podcast. I'll see you again next time. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts and Amazon Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow Podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.